The all-new Hyundai 2024 Santa Fe is equipped with everything you need to break free from the dull work week and embark on an adventurous weekend with your family. The all-new Hyundai Santa Fe's features like available H-Track all-wheel drive, standard third-row seating, available dual wireless charging pads ensure you can take on any adventure. Available H-Track all-wheel drives so you can take on the dirt trails and kick up some mud. Standard third-row seating so your whole family can experience the thrill together. Available dual wireless charging pads so no one gets stuck in the great outdoors with a dead phone. Whether you're tailgating out in the dirt lot, Carter Finley, shout out Carter Finley, or whether you're whitewater rafting, taking the entire family on an adventurous trip, maybe you're out camping at Mount Rogers. I used to go as a kid. Wish my parents had a Hyundai Santa Fe. The Hyundai Santa Fe is perfect for your family outing. Learn more about the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe at HyundaiUSA.com. Call 562-314-4603 for complete details.
Paramount Plus and the National Park Foundation present A Mountain of Zen. Are you still listening? Good. Take a deep breath. You needed a break. This Earth Week, you can live stream 7 national parks for 7 days on Paramount Plus. So, yes, you can literally stream a stream. Paramount Plus, official streaming partner of the National Park Foundation.
Hey, hey, hey. It's the Pick Six Podcast, specifically the Brady Quinn Show with Brady Quinn. Brady, Reginald, Quinn, how you doing?
I'm doing well, Ryan. How you doing? I got to turn my volume up a little bit, man. I got to get you in here. How you been?
I'm good. Yeah, yeah. I thought I would just make up random middle names for you and see how that went. I like Reginald. You seem like you would. That's like an old school Irish name, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. I think you're right. My middle name's actually Tyler, which wanted to name me after my dad. My dad's first name is Tyrone, but she didn't like Tyrone as much, but she liked the Ty, so it ended up being Tyler instead of that. That's what they compromised on. At least that's what I'm told. So.
You know what? That's interesting. I don't get too far down this road, but it is a strictly sort of like British Isles, Ireland thing where a white guy can have an American black guy's name, like Tyrone. One of my best friends from college is from England. His name is Desmond. He is as white as they come, but it's interesting. So I like that. So I'm going to start calling you Tyrone. Tyrone Quinn. What is
up? You can if you want.
That's awesome. Fantastic. Learn something new about Brady Quinn today. All right, let's get into this. We're going to talk a little TNF preview. Talk about Amazon a little bit and how that's going for them. Las Vegas locker room issues.
Can we first start off with Thursday Night Football on Amazon? I mean, I know the ratings are down. Everyone's kind of drawing that to essentially the matchups, which that's always been the issue, no matter what network has had the Thursday Night Football rights. I guess the bigger question is, did Amazon get duped? Or do you kind of see this as one where – in order to be able to be a part of the NFL in any capacity or package, they kind of had to bite the bullet, go buy the rights to Thursday Night Football in order just to be a part of it, right?
Yeah, that's sort of what it feels like. And, you know, we're talking Bezos money, too. So I guarantee you this probably doesn't hurt him in the pocketbook. I could be wrong. I'm not a billionaire, but I would imagine. The schedule is, like, dog crap terrible. At least it has been to this point. And the good news is it's going to get better, right? So Packers, Titans – this Thursday, and then the upcoming schedule, even though it's Raiders and Rams, that looked good on paper back in August. 49ers, Seahawks, Jaguars, Jets actually looks better now than it did before. And then the season ends with Cowboys, Titans on Thursday night. But it does feel like one of those things where you're like, listen, we're going to make you televise this stuff, and it's going to be some pretty atrocious football. And let's see how it goes. Because I think the long term, obviously, everything is moving to watching things on your smart TV. And I don't know how much longer broadcast is going to be a thing in terms of the traditional sense, but yeah. I'm guessing the long-term payout is worth the short-term pain that Amazon is currently experiencing.
So I've got a little different perspective on it. And I guess it's in part because of the sports betting world. And if you think about live betting in particular, and then how most bets are placed, they're not necessarily placed in the stadium or even at a casino for that matter. By and large, you'd like to be able to increase the ability to be able to bet on someone's phone, at home, on a computer, something like that, iPad, what have you, if they are streaming it. The problem is, as we all know, streaming can sometimes be lagging behind, and that creates a big issue for a lot of the sports betting world. So I think there'll always be a place for the broadcast networks, and there'll always be a place for that to some capacity. Now, how long that transformation takes place, I don't know, but there's nothing, you know, appointment television is basically live events and sports and then news. That's what it is. Everything else you can binge watch somewhere else. So in this world of sports, I think there'll still be this desire to have broadcast networks because of the gambling industry, and at least the ability to still have those live wagers, have live betting go on, which to me is the new frontier for the NFL if they want to increase revenue, right? Like, you can't sell that Thursday night package for, what, $1 billion a year, whatever Amazon decides to pay for it or ended up paying for it. You can't sell it for that unless you feel like there's going to be something else down the road. And I think that's one of the things, in my opinion, at least.
No, the betting angle is an important one, and that's something I don't think about because I just – that's not my world, not because I'm a Puritan. I'm just lazy. But that is important. And I will say, like, when you watch games either, like, in the studio where you get the live feed or even on, like, the HD antennas and you're 45 seconds ahead of, like, streaming, that's bonkers. Like, you're literally watching something that's happened – It's live, clearly, because you're seeing it for the first time, but you're so far behind, especially if you're on Twitter. It's just a weird thing. I mean, I'm sure, like, when you're doing Big Noon Kickoff and you're looking at Twitter and you.
So this is funny. This is funny. I'll actually tell you a story from this past week, not to cut you off. I apologize. So we're sitting in our green room because a lot of times, you know, we're there 2 hours before the game starts. We toss it to the kickoff. We'll watch maybe the first series or so down on the field. But then we go back to a green room so we can watch all the games that are going on. So at halftime, we have some sort of clue as to what's happening in the college football world. So that's usually the reason why we don't just stay on the field the entire game. So at the end of the game last week, you know, we had Apple TV set up. So we're streaming all these different games, right? Well, obviously streaming our own game. Here's the issue. At one point, it had reset and it was lagging behind. So we're watching the game. Everyone's kind of getting ready to go back out on the field after the game because they're going to toss down to us from the booth once the game ends. We kind of get ready to bring them to that next game, that bridge, as they call it in TV. Only one problem. We were like 3 minutes behind, which you don't think that's like much. As soon as we walk down the stairs, we hear the victory bell going off inside the stadium. And I'm looking around, and obviously Matt and Reggie have no idea like what bell that is or what that means. I'm like, that means the game is over. I was like, that means like we need to get down on set in the next 60 seconds or Joel and Gus are going to have to be able to like tap dance the way through this. So we took golf carts. They like flew, like literally drive down the tunnel, all this stuff. Somehow we didn't hit any players or anything. People that run up the tunnel. We make it to the field. We're like sprinting across the field just to jump up on set to be able to do our post game. But literally because of the delay in streaming, we were way off. And then we all sat there afterwards. We're like, how has this not happened like at other points in time throughout the course of the season? It probably did. It just probably wasn't our game that was actually delayed like that.
Yeah, no, 3 minutes is huge. That's a problem. Listen, we can put a man on the moon, but we can't fix the streaming thing. That's my thing. That's my grandpa take of the week. All right, let's talk about this game a little bit. Packers at Titans. I don't know. Here's the thing. And, you know, Breach has brought this up recently. So the Titans this week and then the Eagles next week for the Packers. I don't know. If they win those two games, I'll change my opinion. But as I sit here, I don't feel great about the Packers, even after beating the Cowboys. The Titans are a different story. I think I just continue to sleep on them because they're the Titans and they play in the AFC South and they're not exciting. But where do you feel? How do you feel about these two teams coming into this game based on where they are up to this point in the season?
Well, the Titans are a bit banged up, but I do feel like they've been the better team for the majority of the season. Maybe not necessarily to start off, but like once they got Derrick Henry going, the defense adjusted to not having a guy like Harold Landry. And I think, look, they had kind of had their moments where they're making do with Malik Willis, who, as we all could agree, is very green. He does have some upside and some ability to kind of scramble and make some plays, but this offense right now is better set with Ryan Tannehill behind center. I don't know that anyone's going to debate that. So I think going into this matchup, I would say Tennessee does the one thing that's like Green Bay's glaring weakness, and that's the fact they can't stop the run. And you're going to get a heavy dose of Derrick Henry during the entire course of the game. So how's that going to match up? And we can go back to last week and say, all right, nice win versus the Cowboys, but your body of work showcases that this is an issue for you. And this is an issue before this year. Like it's been a year after year after year they've not been able to stop the run. So you find yourself now having to stop a guy like Derrick Henry and then Ryan Tannehill, who can supplement a little bit in the passing game. And it's going to be tough to stop. You're going to have to put up points like you did versus Dallas, and whether or not Christian Watson can replicate what he did last week, or this is like his jump off point where he'll now be that wide receiver they're hoping he'll be, or that they're not going to be able to stop Aaron Jones. Like, he was a huge piece mm-hmm. of that offense with as many touches as he got, as much as they ran the football. So, look, Aaron Rodgers historically in primetime, like, don't bet against him at Lambeau. Don't bet against him. They're laying 3 points. I don't know, man. The Titans look like a team that, to me at least, it shouldn't be a 3-point underdog. Like, this should be a lot closer spread, I think, based on how they match up as well.
No, I'm with you. And the last time they played in Lambeau, 40-14, Green Bay won. Kevin Byard was talking about that. He actually had a little shout out at the end of the Coach 30. I don't know if you ever watched Coach 30 on Twitter. He does sort of the, I'll send it to you if you haven't seen it. He's hilarious. He does takes on how games, how, like, play by play, how games break down and go sideways in a hurry. And it's like he's in watching film the next day. But a little shout out to Coach 30, which was nice. I'll send you that. It's pretty funny stuff. I'm a great
story. I'll check it out,
by the way. Yeah. Okay. But in terms of Ryan Tannehill, so here's some fun facts if you're a Titans fan. 35 wins since becoming starter for Tennessee in week 7 of 2019. Only Mahomes, Rodgers, and Allen, Josh, have more. That's encouraging. And more to your point, Brady, Derrick Henry's averaging 131 yards per game from November onward over the last three seasons. We're right back, right smack dab in the middle of November. So that's a problem, as you know, for the Packers anyway. It's going to be complicated when Derrick Henry's healthy and he looks to be firing on all cylinders. Let me ask you this, because you've played with young wide receivers, and Christian Watson, the very first pass thrown to him as an NFL player, he dropped a 75-yard touchdown. He had 2 drops of 4, catching fire finally last week.
Yeah.
And he comes from a FCS program that didn't play because of COVID in 2020. How patient should Packers fans be willing to be with him? I think he's a good football player. I thought he was a second-round pick, but obviously he struggled with the transition.
Yeah, I think it's tough for any rookie wide receiver. I mean, you do the mock drafts every year. How many times do we see rookie wide receivers ultimately like hit the scene, hit the ground running? It doesn't seem like it's that often. And if it is, for whatever reason, it seems like it's never a first-round guy. It's like a second-round guy or someone else that we weren't expecting. I would also challenge you just, while I'm talking, to look up Devonta Adams' rookie year there in Green Bay, Jordy Nelson's rookie year there in Green Bay, Greg Jennings' rookie year there in Green Bay. You go back through the years of the history of wide receivers who've been rookies in Green Bay, and it's just taking a while to kind of, get ingrained within the offense, develop that chemistry with the quarterback. You're talking about a West Coast system by and large, a lot of which is built up off of timing and rhythm. And so in doing that, usually you'd say, all right, timing and rhythm, what does that mean? It means my footwork as a quarterback coincides with the footwork of the wide receiver. Now, that's in a perfect world. When you're in off coverage, when you don't have to worry about a defender putting his hands on you and disrupting your release or disrupting how you're going to be able to, get to that spot that you need to get to. So for that reason, it takes a while, whether you're talking about going up against cornerbacks who are in off coverage or even guys who are in press man-to-man coverage. It takes a while to be able to develop that chemistry and that rhythm and timing with a quarterback who's also adjusting to your speed, how you break in and out of cuts, right? So he can anticipate those throws, and then making sure you're both on the same page and seeing the windows that the quarterback's seeing. One of the things that I always would tell young quarterbacks is something that I would do with my wide receivers if they were ever having an issue, like understanding a route concept or the timing of a play. I would say, hey, I'm going to run it. You go be quarterback. Go back in a 5-step drop and a hitch, or in shotgun 3 and a hitch, and I want you to throw it to me, all right? And I want you to then feel what it feels like for me and understanding, like, when I'm letting go of this football, okay? And I'll be like, don't wait. Just hitch once and throw, all right? And then I'll run the route. Now, obviously, I'm not going to be the speed of that wide receiver, but what it does is it paints a perspective for that wide receiver so he understands, okay, that's how he feels or that's what he's seeing as he's releasing the football. And in most cases, the wide receiver is nowhere close to actually where he's going to be unless you're talking about quick game. So that sort of exercise can be helpful, but it also helps if your quarterback's there in the offseason to help developing some of that chemistry with one another when you're doing these sorts of things.
No, that's a great point, because if you're at the top of your drop and then you have to take an extra hitch because the wide receiver isn't where he needs to be, not only does that open you up to getting hit, but it also messes up your timing that you've repped 1,000 times and now you're sort of having to reset both physically and mentally.
It's not even so much that, like, old school West Coast mentality. It's the fact that now you've messed up every single other progression in the read. So if you are late on a hitch to your first read, guess what? Now you're late to 2, you're late to 3, you're late to 4, you're late to 5. If you have 5 guys out in the route, right? So now, like, in a pure progression where you'd like to have all 5 guys incorporated as far as what your read is, and you might be reading from left to right or right to left across the field, now you've literally ruined the timing for every single other subsequent read after that. So that's more of the issue while timing and rhythm and chemistry is so important when you talk about offenses that have a lot to do with timing, which most West Coast offenses do. And there's a lot of the elements within what Matt LaFleur does and what Aaron Rodgers does within that offense. So that takes time. And then you're not even taking into account the fact that the field is lined different. So you go college, the NFL, you know, the hashes are wider in college. The numbers are way wider in the NFL. The hashes are closer. They're off their uprights. You know, the numbers are way closer towards the middle of the field. So then even how you go about spreading the field, right? Where your split is, just understanding that, like, hey, the ball's in the near hash, I have to be on the outside edge of the numbers. Ball's in the far hash, I'm on the inside edge of the numbers. There's all these, like, little, like, nuances and things that they're all important because it all matters for spacing of the field. And when rookie wide receivers don't understand spacing, they don't understand the depth, they don't understand, you know, how, okay, if the guy's going to press me, I may have to take 2 yards off my route because of now the timing of the play, and it's going to take me a little longer to get to the vicinity of where I need to be. There's all those little things that you've got to work on. And it doesn't matter if you're an FCS guy or not, or a lower division, you know, football or not. That's the big hurdle, I think, or pain point that most young receivers go through.
That's a great point because one of the things I keep coming back to as junior draft analysts, as I'm referred to in the Pick Six podcast, is that, like, Hendon Hooker.
Hold on. What?
I said Brinson calls me junior draft analyst. That's his little joke.
Who's the senior?
Oh, there is no one. I'm only a one-man show, and I'm still junior. That's the.
So they don't give you the senior title; they only give you the junior title.
That's Brinson's joke. No one else is calling me.
What an a-hole Brinson is. Seriously, an absolute a-hole.
But my point, to follow up your point, is that Hendon Hooker is going to be an interesting guy to try to figure out because he plays in that offense where, I mean, if you watch the Alabama-Tennessee game, they have guys on the field side, wide receivers, that are literally right next to the sidelines. And there were Hendon Hooker can throw, he has a good arm. He's throwing these balls to the field side on those in-breaking routes. But there's so much real estate there because of what you're talking about, the hash marks and the numbers and the splits, that it creates a situation that you're never, ever going to see in the NFL.
Yeah, I mean, it's seldom seen, I should say, right? Like, there's only, like, the Chip Kelly Philadelphia Eagles era, maybe before Nick Foles was that quarterback, where he would push and have those super wide splits that would do – it would accomplish a couple of things, right? Like, the first thing you're trying to do is clear up the box count. Like, you really put the defense in a conflict because they have to decide, do I want to play the two stacked wide receivers that are basically standing on the sideline, or do I want to have that guy try to middle them? That is he accomplishing – being a part of the, you know, stopping the run or coverage right now, or is he in no man's land? So you really force the box count to identify itself. It makes it harder to pressure too if you're trying to bring one of those guys without having to show it. And then finally, it puts your DBs on islands. I mean, especially the way Josh Heupel and that crew likes to call plays, and it really goes back to, like, the Art Briles days. Like, usually you've got read routes, and it's all based on how they're going to play those stack alignments. You know, if the guy's off and inside, you might be running by him. You might be running a comeback or some sort of, you know, outside breaking route. If he's playing outside of you, you're probably running in and breaking route. You can run screens off of that. There's all sorts of little variations of it. But a lot of it happens at the snap of the football, and you've got to be able to read it on the run. And so, yeah, it's difficult for a wide receiver, but it's pretty simple. They don't ask you to do a ton of things.
Right.
And that's where I think it becomes a hard transition for wide receivers in that system. But then for quarterbacks, it becomes a harder transition because it's so foreign to what you're asked to do in the NFL. You know, you're not reading the same types of, like, tighter coverages and movement and so forth like you see in the NFL. It's not the quite variety of routes and progressions you're going to see either. So that all plays a factor in it. Go back and look through Josh Heupel's career, and I want to say you probably have to go back to his time in Oklahoma, where you could look at quarterbacks who were able to excel not only in that offense, but also at the next level, because it is such a stark contrast as compared to what you're asked to do. You could even make that case for some of the quarterbacks who play within the Art Briles system. It's just an apples to oranges comparison. And it's not to say that it's bad. Like, I'm fascinated to see what it would look like if you got that in the NFL on a consistent basis. I mean, you did see it a little bit from Chip Kelly and some of that early stuff he did in Philly. And obviously he won 20 games, at least the first two regular seasons that he was there. And offensively, like, Nick Foles had maybe his best season ever. You know, Sam Bradford had a pretty solid, you know, season playing within that system. So there's something to be said for being able to space the field or create space in the NFL, because a lot of people look to do that through the draft by drafting faster players or signing faster players. Right. And then meanwhile, you can just formationally do it. And then you can put these, some of these guys on islands and isolate them. So it's fascinating. It'll be fascinating to see how he's viewed. I love Hendon Hooker. I think he's a great kid. You can tell by the way he carries himself. Mm-hmm. He has all the tools and fundamentals. I would be fascinated to see where he ends up going. I know this. He's high on my list when I compare like what he's done on tape and what he's done as compared to like a Will Levis, who a lot of people are going to drool about because of the arm strength,
yep,
how easy the ball jumps on the screen, his athleticism and all that. But then you look how bad that offense has struggled. And I know he's playing banged up. I want to give him the benefit of the doubt, but still like a stark comparison between the two players and how each of the seasons have gone so far.
Yeah, that's right. Those are great points, and I'm sure things we'll be talking about for the next 6 months. So quickly here, we got, let's see, Devontae Adams, first year with Aaron Rodgers, 38 receptions, 446 yards, 3 touchdowns. Okay. Greg Jennings, first year, was 2006. So that was with Favre.
It was Favre.
Yeah, yikes. 45 catches, 632 yards, 3 touchdowns also. Jordy Nelson, first year, 2008, which is actually the first year that Aaron Rodgers took over. 33 receptions, 366 yards, 2 touchdowns. So Watson is only at 19. Is what he has. What is it? How many catches does he have? He has he has 14 catches, 195 yards.
Which I think he'll get to. We're a little more than the halfway point of the season, right? Like, I think he'll get to probably like that 30-ish number.
Yeah.
And how many yards did he say he has right now?
195. Is that right?
Yeah, it sounds about right. I mean, he hasn't obviously played. He's been a little bit banged up.
Oh, yeah. So he had 107 just in that one game. Okay.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, literally just off that. If he's replicating that, he'll blow those numbers out of the water. But
right.
I don't think that's going to happen. I mean, the truth is, though, he'll be in that vicinity, right, as far as receptions.
Yeah.
Maybe a little further in yards. And then, obviously, touchdowns. If he adds a few more, he'll surpass that. But that's kind of status quo, right? Like, that's what we've seen from other wide receivers who've been the number one in their first year. I just think anyone who is looking at Christian Watson coming in, and I don't care if he was a part of, you know, Alabama or Georgia or whatever program you want to talk about, Ohio State, because those guys are studs. Maybe Ohio State's the exception, right? Because you've got Garrett Wilson, who's coming right away, made an impact, and Chris Olave, too.
Olave's doing well, absolutely.
Well, yeah. I'm going to go out on a limb here. I think Marvin Harrison Jr. is going to be just fine transitioning into the NFL, and Jaxon Smith-Njigba will be okay. I know he's been banged up this year, but kind of similar feeling. Maybe with the exception of the Ohio State and the job Brian Hartline does preparing those guys, most of them, I think, get into the NFL and there's going to be a acclimation period. There's going to be a maturation process and their best football is probably still ahead of them. And I think that's definitely the case for Christian Watson. But as it relates to the Tennessee Titans, it should be a good matchup versus that secondary. But I don't know. The defense has played pretty well for Tennessee. You know, I think it'll be interesting to see if Rodgers and the Packers can replicate what they did. Because I think a part of that is being able to run the football as much as they did with Aaron Jones and not ask, you know, them to do too much in the passing game.
Right. Let me ask you this, and we'll take a quick break. And, you know, you can be as specific or less so as vague as you want to be. I feel like this is just me talking here, that Matt LaFleur, maybe not overrated as a coach, but he's benefited from having Aaron Rodgers. Whereas I feel like we underrate Mike Vrabel, and he quietly is one of the best coaches in the NFL. Where do you come down on that? Because I think that we, like I just said earlier, you know, I don't think about the Titans a lot because they don't play quote unquote interesting football and they're in the AFC South. But every time I watch them closely, Vrabel seems like he's doing the right thing. And again, LaFleur, I don't know, just because of Aaron Rodgers, he might be great or he just might be a dude.
I think you've got both ends of the spectrum with that. One, I love Mike Vrabel. I mean, he's a hell of a coach. I don't care if it's situationally, the way those guys play for him. I mean, kind of the love that he shows. Was it Ben Jones the other week after the game? He was just kind of hugging on him, understanding like physically what he put into that game. There's something to that. Like I think now more than ever, especially in the NFL, you see in college, in high school, and maybe just in society, but like relationships matter, man, when they're real. And I think he's got that connection. with the players on that team, you know, and there's not a lot of guys in the NFL who are coaches that have that sort of relationship where you ever see them show that sort of affection towards a player and have that connection. But I think he's got that with the entire locker room. Right. So you've got like that end of the spectrum. And I think, you know, in some cases, look, he's got arguably the best running back in the league. Derrick Henry probably is, with the exception of in his own mind, he thinks it's Nick Chubb, which is kind of odd, but whatever. But if you look at that roster by and large, like it's a good roster. I don't know that we're saying it's, I don't know, is it the top 10 most talented? Is it top half maybe? I don't know where you rank it. I think he's been able to maximize that group. I mean, they've been as consistent as any team in winning football games. And, you know, he deserves a lot of credit for that. And so there's like that end of it. And then there's the other end where you've got Matt LaFleur, who's, I also think, is a really good coach. But we questioned that maybe because of the quarterback situation, because Rodgers has played so well since he's been there. But I think you got to give LaFleur a little credit for it, right? I think you have to give him credit for how he manages the whole situation.
Sure.
It's almost like Phil Jackson, with whether it's with the Bulls or with the Lakers, everyone feels like, oh, I could easily go there and be the coach and make this work. It's like, really? I don't know. I mean, look at the Brooklyn Nets right now. Look at the Los Angeles Lakers. Like, just because you have LeBron and all these, you know, all-stars doesn't mean it's going to equate to wins. And you can make the same case for the Nets and how that worked out with Steve Nash for a minute. So I think it might even be just as difficult, if not more difficult, when you've got a roster loaded with stars, because the expectations that you're going to win. It should be a Super Bowl. It should be a long playoff run. And if you don't, you're a disappointment. Like, that's got to be a tough thing to feel every single week. Whereas if we drop a game, I mean, think about how the Packers have been viewed this year. Like, we're counting them out. And honestly, they're like, I think, two games out from being in the playoffs right now. If the playoffs ended right now, they're behind Washington, but they're in that next spot. So they're like kind of still knocking on the door, but no one's giving them any credit.
They started 3-1 and they lost 5 straight, and then they just beat the Cowboys. So no, I get it. And I think you're right. All right, let's take a quick break and then we'll come back and talk about another organization full of stars that ain't quite living up to expectations.
MTV's official Challenge podcast is back for another season.
And so are we.
I'm Tori Deal.
And I'm Anissa Ferreira.
The wait is over, guys. All Stars 4 is finally here.
And this season takes it to a whole new level. Old school legends, modern power players, and ex-lovers are all competing in Cape Town, South Africa for the prize of $300,000.
And we're going to be right here along with you fans, covering every episode on the podcast.
Listen to MTV's official Challenge podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
The chilling new original docuseries on Paramount Plus.
Why did he kill his family? The answer lies across the ocean in a woman named Sylvie.
She's a CAN model.
Where desire leads to deception.
I ended up spending $12,000 and $15,000 a day.
It was addictive.
I can't get you out.
And obsession leads to murder.
Who did this to your family?
You can't really maintain a fantasy forever.
Control Alt Desire. Now streaming on Paramount Plus.
All right, Brady. Las Vegas Raiders locker room issues. Here's the thing. Like, you arrived in Denver after Josh McDaniels had been fired. He was there in 2010. I think he left in 2011. Is that right?
So I got there in 2010. So I got there after his first season. His first season was 2009.
Okay, so you played for him.
Yeah, I played for him. Played a year for him. Now, he was only there for 12 games. There was the Spygate 2.0 incident in London. And then I think a week or two after that all came out, he ended up getting fired from that. I don't know if it was a direct result of that or if it was a combination of the prior season. Remember, they got off that 6-0 start. They beat New England.
Red hot.
And then they went 2-8 down the stretch. And then the next part of that next season, you know, didn't get off to a great start. And so that I think ultimately led, along with the Spygate thing and everything else, and ultimately led to his dismissal. But in that period of time being there with him, I mean, look, he's a brilliant, brilliant coach. It goes to show you that, like, it doesn't always work out for some of the guys who are like some of the best X's and O's. Like, sometimes they just inherit something that's tough, or the ball doesn't bounce their way. You have some unlucky, you know, situations. But that was a season that was really interesting, because I learned a lot from him. You know, just the way he called plays and how he diagrammed things up. I would put him up against anyone. I really would, as far as his offensive acumen and his ability to be able to put up stats, numbers, drives, whatever you want. Like, he has the ability to do that.
So let me ask you this, and then we'll dig a little deeper. So it felt like, on the outside looking in, that, and he sort of admitted this in subsequent years, that he was thought he knew everything and he wishes he did some things differently. He came across as aloof sometimes. And at the end of the day, I don't care, but it seemed like it bothered him a little bit in retrospect. 12 years later, he gets the Vegas job, and this feels like an absolute home run. So not only does he have Derek Carr, who's a really good quarterback, they trade for Devontae Adams. No one questions it, even though it's a first-round pick and change, whatever it ended up being, because you're like, okay, this is going to work. He handpicked this place. He had turned down offers previously, including backing out of that Colts job a few years ago before Frank Reich ended up taking it. I don't know if you've talked to him in the years since, but did it feel like to you that this was going to be the good fit based on the time he took to figure himself out and all that other stuff? And I would imagine you're surprised everyone else this thing has gone south so quickly.
I am surprised it's gone south. However, I do think they overachieved last year. Like, I didn't have the Raiders being a playoff team this year. I didn't have them looking this bad. I mean, I think the AFC West, by and large, I didn't think the Broncos were not going to be a playoff team either. And it seems like they're headed in that direction. You know, look, there's still a lot of football left to be played, in my opinion, as far as what the season can end up looking like. And I think if you look at his demise in Denver, probably one of the issues was he took on too much responsibility. You know, he was taking on responsibility not as the head coach, but obviously personnel decisions and all that. That's not my understanding of how this is working in Las Vegas, right? The general manager was hired first, then Josh McDaniels was kind of handpicked as that working relationship that you see so often now in the NFL, where those two are working in unison. And go back and look at Gruden's first year. What did he start out? 1-7? 2-7? Something like that? I mean, there's been some slow starts. I think Art Schell got off to a slow start when he started with the Raiders. I mean, if you go through the history of the Raiders, it's not always the worst thing if you start off slow. You just have to eventually start winning some football games. And I think if you look at his demise then going back to Denver, probably maybe one of the worst things that happened to him was that 6-0 start.
Yep.
Like, you get 6-0, you light the world on fire, and you beat, you know, you beat your old boss and Bill Belichick, and everyone's like talking great about you. Well, then when the season ends up 8-8, feels like an awful 8-8. Like, I remember, like, that next year or so after Josh got fired, John Fox came in. We finished the season 8-8. But even though we actually finished on a 3-game losing streak, but at 8-8, it tied us for the division. We won the tiebreaker, I believe, over the Raiders that year. So we ended up winning the AFC West.
Is that the Steelers playoff game?
That was the next week. Yeah, the next week was the wild card Steelers playoff game. Yeah, yeah. Which was bizarre because the Steelers decided to play a defense that no one the last 3 weeks played, and they beat us every single time with it. And so going into that game, you're like, obviously they're going to do exactly what everyone else has done to stop us. And they didn't. They were very stubborn about wanting to kind of play their style of defense, and it ended up coming to bite them when it was all said and done. But of course, we played the Patriots in the next round, and they just did the exact same thing they did at the end of the season to us, and we stood no chance. But to get back to the McDaniels, you know, part of it, I think the slow start right now in the short term, we're like, man, what is happening? It sounds like there's locker room issues, though. It sounds like there's some guys who aren't bought in. You know, you look at a guy like Jonathan Abram. Now, I know he's a, you know, previous draft pick, but for whatever reason, they want to move on from him.
And I mean, they cut him in year four. That's not great in the middle of the season.
No, and I don't know if it's, you know, in the middle of the season, I think is what bothers me most. If it was before the season, it would make some sense, but you know, clearly they didn't trade him. They didn't try to get rid of him before the season. They wait till they're in season to do it. So you kind of wonder, like, are people not buying in to what he's preaching or what they're pushing for? I mean, Derek Carr said that. Devontae Adams has said that. I think Josh McDaniels has alluded to that. So I think it's going to take some time before they get this organization like where they maybe want or need it to be. And I think last year, because they overachieved, it makes this year look bad. But I am I'm still buying what this team is capable of being, and I think what they will be in the future. I think if you hit the panic button now, you make a big mistake.
I think you're right. And I think you're right because in part that guys like Derek Carr and Devontae Adams are coming out and saying what they're saying. They're not pointing fingers at Josh McDaniels. And look, man, to his credit, he's not throwing hissy fits at the press conference and calling his players out. He's just sort of taking his medicine, and it seems like Mark Davis, good or bad, based on, you know, previous decisions he's made, is sticking with him. I mean, there's a huge buyout that has something to do with it, I get. But I think part of the concern, and look, this is my concern with the Raiders. I mean, Jack Del Rio basically had to announce that he was getting fired at his press conference to say that he won 12 games with that team the year before. They were going to make a pretty deep playoff run had Derek Carr not got hurt. And it seems like Rich Bisaccia exceeded expectations, and it seems like Davis gets distracted by shiny objects and sometimes to the team's detriment. But I'm sort of with you. I don't think he can – I don't know. It's not great to lose to the Colts, but
and well, you had to settle with John Gruden too, right?
And that staff.
And I mean, so you're talking about an owner who inherited the team. He wasn't David Tepper, where he made his money elsewhere and then bought the team, or the Walton family, right? Which, when you start looking at some of the other owners there who have deep pockets, they can make those quicker decisions because they've got a lot of cash on hand. They're not looking at the cash that's being spun off from the team as part of their livelihood. That's not the case for Mark Davis, right? He obviously has the relocation fees, everything that goes along with that. So it's hard then to move on from a head coach when you just had to move on from a head coach and settle with him on whatever that payout was, general manager too, the rest of the assistants. Then you're going to do that all over again. And then I think because of how you hired your general manager, you're either looking at him with a little side eye saying, well, why would I trust your opinion then on the next guy since this guy didn't work out?
Yeah.
Or you're just clean slate, you're moving on from all of them. So it's a really expensive proposition. I personally hate when owners overreact, especially in year one. It takes a while to allow this stuff to be turned around. And I know you can look at like a Kevin O'Connell with the Vikings and go, well, they're 8-1. Look at the job he's doing. Well, they weren't that bad of a football team the past few years, you know, and they were kind of, they had a talented roster before that. It's now just maybe a coach that gets along with the quarterback and is buying into him. Weird. We see that down in Miami too. How's that working out? So maybe that's, you know, more, you know, what this has to do with than anything else. It's just getting that roster where it needs to be, where everyone's buying in.
Yeah. And don't forget the haircut budget. Mark Davis is spending a lot on that. So that's also something to keep in mind. All right. A little something we like to call read between the lines. So Brady, Rodgers says this offense isn't sustainable. Now, he made those same comments October 3rd after they eked their way to a victory over the Patriots with Bailey Zappi to move to 3-1. They have lost five straight since. They just beat the Cowboys, as I mentioned earlier. And Rodgers wasn't super pumped about how that went down. What does this mean to you?
I think he wants to have probably more control over some things. I think once they get the passing game going. I mean, that's how I see it, right? Like, he's saying it's not sustainable because they got to be able to put up points. So if you want to run the football a bunch, if you want to hand off to Aaron Jones a bunch, that's fine. But it puts too much pressure on our defense. We're going to be playing, we're getting less possessions because it's going to shorten the game. And our defense is going to put a lot of pressure on them to hold down the opponent. And so I do think, and look, you saw Matt LaFleur and Aaron Rodgers get into it at the end of this past week's game because, you know, Aaron Rodgers is thinking, I can end this game in regulation. We're getting close to like a 2-minute drive and the ability to do that. So let me call the plays, let me do my thing, and let's end this thing. And that wasn't the direction that Matt LaFleur, you know, elected to go. We find ourselves now in a situation where I think if you're looking at this team moving forward, I'll be curious to see tomorrow, you know, tonight, tomorrow night, depending on your when you're watching this, versus the Titans, what the offense looks like. If it's going to be two teams trying to establish the line of scrimmage running the football, or if you see the Packers now trying to open things up because of what Christian Watson did this past Sunday.
And you can correct me if I'm wrong, but you're of the opinion that those sort of sideline spats that we talked previously, you and I, about Tommy Rees and
Drew Pine. Yeah.
Drew Pine, thank you. And then, of course, Kyler and Cliff. No issue for you? That's just football? Or do there variations based on the circumstances?
It's just football. I mean, you spend so much time with whoever's calling the plays, whether it's your OC, your head coach, whoever, and going over this stuff that, I mean, you, during the season, you spend more time than you do with them, than your wife, your girlfriend, you know, anyone else in your life. So you're going to have spats and you're going to have arguments and you're going to, and it's heated. It's football. Like, that's just how it works. So all those things come out and you can't always read into them as, oh, this is like that, you know, that relationship that's unable to be repaired. You know, it's just untenable at this point. It's not like that. It's just, that's football. There's a lot of emotions that go involved in it. And I think when you've got a guy who's proven himself, who's what, a four-time MVP, he's going to carry a lot of weight with what he says and what he wants to be done. Most players, it's a little different because most players aren't Aaron Rodgers. And it's a little harder then to make those claims on how you think things should be run and that people are going to listen to you. Usually you're just taking direction from the head coach. When you're paid like he is, when you've played like he is, it's a little different. It's more of working together.
Yeah. What would happen if you came off the field and said to Charlie Weiss at Notre Dame, calm the F down? Like literally, what would happen?
We had a conversation like that one time, actually, back to Michigan State. Yeah.
Oh, okay. It was
like a rainstorm. It was awful weather. It's like one of those days where it was like 40, windy and raining. I mean, which is the worst to play football in.
Right.
I'd rather be 17 degrees and snowing than 40 degrees and raining. So I wasn't getting the snaps very well. from center. Our center then, John Sullivan, snapped hard. Like every single season when we first like started like training camp and all that, he would split my thumb on my right hand because he'd snap so hard, which is great though, because you want a center who snaps fast. You get the ball, you get out from under center, you get on with the play. But I would literally have to like wait till my thumb would stop bleeding and callus over at some point in the season before it'd feel normal again. But he would snap so hard that when you're in the rain like that, and obviously you've got a ball that's fully inflated, this isn't the Deflate Gate, the New England Patriots. Ooh. That thing's going to like, it's going to hit. And if it doesn't hit perfectly, you know, on your hand, or if your hand's wet, it's going to skip. It's going to slide off to the side, you know, one way or another. It might split your hands. And so I'd fumbled a couple snaps. And when I came over the sidelines, there was, you know, some words said to me and I had some words back to him, and then that was it. So,
and you got on with things, it.
Yeah, we got things worked out after that. But I think in that moment he realized like there was no one as frustrated as I was based on what was happening. Like I'm fumbling a snap on national television in prime time. Like, you don't think that I'm frustrated right now with the conditions and the circumstances. Like, trust me, like I want to win this game too. I obviously want to be able to take a snap from under center.
I love it. I've never seen you not be, you know, super cool under pressure. So I look forward to the day when people.
Yeah, I'm just glad the cameras didn't catch me there, because I would have, my mom wouldn't have been proud of that moment.
Yeah, your mom's proud of you, Brady. Before we move on from Aaron Rodgers, let me ask you this. He made comments about the grass fields, and I'm with him 100% as an old person who has torn their ACL previously. I don't understand why owners who are so money conscious in terms of the player investment are so short-sighted about these turf fields, because they can put out all the studies they want. There's no one disputing that turf is in any way equal to or better than grass fields. What do you think about his comments on that?
No, I think it's true. I mean, obviously if you look at these, Premier League teams, and these other soccer teams that are incredible, they don't play on turf, right?
They're 40 pounds. They're not 300 pound guys.
Right, which like makes even more sense as to why you'd want to make sure your field conditions are that of which are as good as they can be for your players. So it's a bit surprising from that standpoint. I think, honestly, though, we understate the revenue that's able to be generated in the stadiums that do have turf, and the cost of if you have grass, having to replace it over and over and maintain it and all that. When you think about all the different events and things you can have there, right? If you have a turf field, you're able to have not only, you know, college games there, high school, whatever you want, whatever events you want, concerts and all that. And it's not obviously going to impact that field necessarily the way it would be if it was a natural surface. Right. So, you know, there's all those costs and things that I think we think of during football season. We're like, well, this isn't in the best interest of the players. But you have to also think about the rest of the year while that stadium's sitting there. They're trying to pump out as much as they can from that. So you're going to see like a concert or whatever, you know, whatever they had to put in there, a truck rally. I don't know.
Yeah.
But there's going to be a circus. I mean, there's going to be all sorts of other things that they're going to have at these venues, these stadiums. And that's going to impact obviously the quality of the grass, turf, what have you, what's down there. So I think it's probably, they're actually able to generate a little more revenue too by having it be turf than people realize. But I still haven't understood, like, do what Steve Bisciotti did. You know, you've got a quarterback who likes to run, take off. He's like, this is in the best interest of my team, the long-term success for our team. I'm going to go back to grass. And trust me, I remember playing on that field turf in Baltimore. It was one of the hardest, faster services like there was. And I'll never forget warming up when I was out there and they had an official going around testing different spots because it was just barely at the threshold of how soft it needed to be. Like, it was one of the harder fields that we had ever played on at that point, which felt like it was pretty unsafe.
Yeah. In fact, there's a time prior to, I don't know if you were in the league or not, but Brian Billick, when he was the coach of the Ravens, actually refused to play a preseason game because the field, not in Baltimore, but was in such disarray. All right, we got 10 minutes, Brady. Let's do some more of these read between the lines here. Ron Rivera sort of talking about the quarterback situation. And he's mentioned something about momentum. Taylor Heinicke has momentum. You can see it here. You look at what is best for the team, and that's how it has to be. Whoever starter is, I will commit to them fully. I don't want them looking over their shoulder. Carson Wentz coming off the finger surgery. Is there any way possible that you're going back to Carson Wentz?
I don't think so right now. And honestly, I don't know that, you know, Heinicke's a better quarterback. I think Wentz is probably more talented, at least as a passer. But this team's playing for Heinicke. I mean, you look at the momentum that they have right now, and I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that when he's in there, he's a little more mobile. He creates and buys more time. They're taking less sacks. He's not as great of a passer, but you know, if you're able to get a little more out of the running game, not take as many negative plays, put your team in better field position, even though he is throwing about a pick a game. I think you ride this wave, you ride this momentum. It stinks because you obviously gave up something to go get him, but it's hard right now because you got to climb back into the most competitive or one of the most competitive divisions in the NFL and the NFC East.
Which is crazy to say out loud.
Both the AFC East and the NFC East.
I know.
So it's crazy to think how the season's gone this far. There's a lot of games left to be played still, but I don't know. I think he's basically saying to everyone, like, get ready. Heineke's going to be a starter for the rest of the season, even when Wentz is back.
Yeah, Wentz can't catch a break. And I think part of the issue is the frustration. Wentz is obviously frustrated, but the team's so desperate to find a quarterback that they're willing to talk themselves into players that probably aren't starting quarterback caliber anymore. No disrespect to Carson Wentz, but that's just the reality. And I wondered coming into the season if there was going to be a huge difference in terms of productivity. And, you know, here we are. It's the same old, same old. All right.
It's such a tough task, though, too. I mean, you're asking him to go from Philly to Indy to, you know, to Washington in a 3-year stint and then learn all these different systems.
Yeah.
And, you know, try to develop chemistry with those guys. So, you know, I think if you look at least statistically what he was doing last year in Indy, they'd take that production over what we've seen so far from the Colts on offense.
Yes.
But it seems like that entire team's playing at a different level right now. But again, I digress. I just think he's also been put in a tough spot. Like, I will give him the benefit of the doubt in that regard.
No, I agree with you. Absolutely. But that's, you know, you don't blame the guy cashing the checks. You blame the guy writing them. And that's all.
By the way, think about the first 3 weeks of his NFL career when they beat Pittsburgh in week 3.
Smoked
they named
him.
It Wentzylvania. Right. They had the early bye week 4. And at that point, like, he was, he was the man. And I kind of talked about like the start for Josh McDaniels in Denver. And then the 2-8 finish that first season, it kind of played into his demise.
Yeah.
I wonder how much of that too, like, just, it was outlandish expectations for Wentz. And then he gets hurt. What, the following year, that season where he's playing so well, looks like an MVP candidate.
2017 towards ACL.
And he never really was able to recoup and be the same type of athlete that he was. At least at the quarterback spot, like we saw that season.
Yeah, not only that, as he's recovering, Nick freaking Foles leads the team to the Super Bowl. I mean, you can't even make that stuff up. Also, something you can't make up, the Vikings are 8-1. And, oh, by the way, they're getting points at home. How do you explain that one?
I don't know. I mean, you tell me. I mean, either I'm a fish and I'm on the hook for this one, or it's a bad matchup. Someone knows something. Again, you're talking about a Dallas Cowboys team that just lost this past week. And now they're going on the road to go play a team in the Vikings who are a good football team. I mean, you beat the Buffalo Bills. And mind you, think about the things they had to overcome. A catch that wasn't by Gabe Davis. Yes. 12 men on the field at one point tried to stop Dalvin Cook. That didn't get called. I mean, they had a lot of things up against them. They found a way to win that game. I'm a bit surprised by this. Call me a fish, but I'll gladly take the 1 point. Like, if I'm the Vikings – and not that you should ever talk about sports gambling and betting, I am using this as bulletin board material, as motivation, saying, like, we are 8-1 and we're playing at home, and no one can give us the decency to at least even say, hey, you guys should be laying a pointer. You guys should be the favorite. We're the underdog at home. That's incredible.
I feel like this is a play by Vegas to appeal to Cowboys fans. And like, it's an audience of one. Cowboys fans, things, they're going to bounce back after the Packers game. Our guy, Steven O. Sportsline, who does millions of simulations. The first thing he says in the write-up is, in all caps, Minnesota insulted as a home underdog and should cover. And he also notes in his notes that Dallas's run defense is basically, they're terrible. They allow 5 yards per carry. Dalvin Cook is going to go crazy.
Yeah. I mean, in that offensive line group, credit Chris Cooper, offensive line coach up there in Minnesota, like, they've continually come along this year. You know, they got some youth on that group and they've come along, gotten better and better. Kirk Cousins played phenomenal. We know how good Jefferson and Thielen and even KJ Osborne, like, people don't give him enough credit. And Hockenson, like, he's gotten up to speed quick in this offense. It's just, they're a good team. Their defense is molding into what I think Ed Donatell wants in that back end as far as the coverage. So Darius Smith's one of the better edge rushers. Like, all in all, like, that is a good football team.
Absolutely. All right, finally, let's stay in the old NFC North here. Matt LaFleur. So he moved on from Amari Rodgers, who had 8 catches and 7 fumbles in his career, I think. That typically doesn't keep you on a football team very long. But he also cut Kylan Hill, and he didn't speak in specifics, but he said it was being a Packer is a privilege, and Billy put the quote on the screen here. It's a tough deal. I would say this. Being a member of the Green Bay Packers is a privilege. As someone who's been in a lot of locker rooms, like, is this like, what's up?
I almost feel like he's making an example out of him. And there was probably something that happened, didn't get out, stayed in house. You know, when you're in a small market like Green Bay, you can keep a lot of things undercover. Like that That's actually end up happening like in around town, right? Like a lot of people want to make sure the Packers, especially after a nice win, that there's not, there's, you know, they don't hear something about it. So sometimes I think after a win like that, and again, they're not out of it by any means, but they do have an uphill battle. Sometimes you still have to send a message to the locker room. And maybe that's one where whatever he did, whether it's he, you know, didn't decide to go out and party and not show up for meetings, not taking something seriously. It's usually one of those messages. And I think for Matt LaFleur, he probably feels it's as important as any other time in his career, because he does have to start to set a precedent moving forward for after Aaron Rodgers is there, right? Like he's had to treat Aaron Rodgers like a unicorn and then have like everyone else. Well, eventually this thing's going to turn where you've got a quarterback that's just like one of the other guys. Like you're not going to treat him different than everyone else. You're going to make him come to the offseason. You're going to make him be a part of all this. You're going to have a different working relationship. They just happen to be, you know, they happen to have a quarterback who's a Hall of Famer currently still playing. And so that working relationship is a little different how they have to treat him. And I think this is one of those moves you make that, at least in my mind, I think of what round did they take him this year? He's a rookie, if I'm not mistaken.
He's a second or third year guy. Yeah, he's like a day. He's a day three guy. Let me double check. But yeah. Mississippi State, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
And which was odd too, because like he complained. It's funny going back through his history. There were some rumblings too, like he didn't like his role within Mississippi State.
Because he was in the Leach offense. Yeah,
he did catch the football well, and at times he was highlighted. It's funny too, because now like they have some balance. Like Leach is running the football decently well with Mississippi State now. But
yeah,
he has to be a second-year player. I can't be losing my mind at that much.
2021 draft, seventh-round pick. He was actually one of the last players drafted. That's right. All right, that's it for the old Brady Quinn football show. But by the way, I think you've actually sold me on Matt LaFleur having to do a lot more than just X's and O's in terms of dealing with the unicorn. And then I think you make a good point that if he is, in fact, setting an example of this and a message to the rest of the crew that, you know, this ain't Fantasy Island. You can't just show up when you want to. But
well, yeah, I think most people realize that when they get to Green Bay, though.
Fair enough. But that's it for the old Brady Quinn football show. Tyrone, it was good to see you, my man. And yeah, we'll talk soon.
All right.
New CBS Monday. NCIS is back.
We need all hands on deck.
So grab your gear.
NCIS!
And join our elite team.
What are the charges?
Murder.
New cases to be solved.
Double tap to the chest.
Same caliber as the murder weapon.
And new criminals to catch.
That's the bomb maker. Where's the bomb?
A new NCIS, Monday, 9/8 Central, on CBS and streaming on Paramount+.